Strategy. Don't play games you don't understand, even if you see lots of other people making money from them. Figure out the game when the stakes aren't high. Don't cheat. Cheaters never win in the long run. Stick to your principles. You need to adjust your style of play throughout the night as the dynamics of the game change. Be flexible. Be patient and think long term. The players with the most stamina and focus usually win. Differentiate yourself. Do the opposite of what the rest of the table is doing. Hope is not a good plan. Don't let yourself go on tilt. It's much more cost-effective to take a break, walk around, or leave the game for the night. Continual learning. Educate yourself. Read books and learn from others who have done it before. Learn by doing. Theory is nice, but nothing replaces actual experience. Learn by surrounding yourself with talented players. Just because you win a hand doesn't mean you're good and you don't have any more learning to do. You might have just gotten lucky. Don't be afraid to ask for advice. Culture. You've got to love the game. To become really good, you need to live it and sleep it. Don't be cocky. Don't be flashy. There's always someone better than you. Be nice and make friends. It's a small community. Share what you've learned with others. Look for opportunities beyond just the game you sat down to play. You never know who you're going to meet, including new friends for life or new business contacts. Have fun. The game is a lot more enjoyable when you're trying to do more than just make money. Aside from remembering to focus on what's best for the long term, I think the biggest business lesson I learned from poker concerned the most important decision you can make in the game. Although it seems obvious in retrospect, it took me 6 months before I finally figured it out. Through reading poker books and practicing by playing, I spent a lot of time learning about the best strategy to play once I was actually sitting down at a table. My big aha moment came when I finally learned that the game started even before I sat down in a seat. In a poker room at a casino, there are usually many different choices of tables. Each table has different stakes, different players, and different dynamics that change as the players come and go, and as players get excited, upset, or tired. I learned that the most important decision I could make was which table to sit at. This included knowing when to change tables. I learned from a book that an experienced player can make 10 times as much money sitting at a table with 9 mediocre players who are tired and have a lot of chips, compared with sitting at a table with 9 really good players who are focused and don't have that many chips in front of them. In business, one of the most important decisions for an entrepreneur or a CEO to make is what business to be in. It doesn't matter how flawlessly a business is executed, if it's the wrong business, or if it's in too small a market. Imagine if you were the most efficient manufacturer of 7-fingered gloves. You offer the best selection, the best service, the best prices for 7-fingered gloves. But if there isn't a big enough market for what you sell, you won't get very far. Or if you decide to start a business that competes directly against really experienced competitors such as Walmart by playing the same game they play, for example, trying to sell the same goods at a lower price, then chances are you will go out of business. In a poker room, I could only choose which table I wanted to sit at. But in business, I realized that I didn't have to sit at an existing table. I could define my own, or make the one I was already at even bigger. Or, just like in a poker room, I could always choose to change tables. I realized that, whatever the vision was for any business, there was always a bigger vision that could make the table bigger. When Southwest Airlines first started, they didn't see their target market as limited to just existing airline travelers, which was what all the other airlines did. Instead, they imagined their service as something that could potentially serve all the people who traveled by Greyhound bus or by train, and they designed their business around that. They offered short flights at cheap prices instead of going with the more prevalent hub-and-spoke model that other airlines were using. They made it easy for customers to change their flights without paying huge penalties. And they turned their planes around at airports as fast as possible. They succeeded because they decided to play at a different table than the one that all the other airlines were playing at. Over a period of several months, I learned a lot about poker. But toward the end, I started getting bored with playing in the California card rooms. Part of the reason was that I started noticing it was the same players who were showing up all the time, and many of them seemed to be playing full-time, either because they didn't have anything else to do, or were trying to win their rent money for the month. After I'd spent several months learning and practicing the mathematics of the game, playing Limit Hold'em started to feel more and more mechanical and less challenging. So, I started making weekend trips to Las Vegas, and found the game much more interesting there. I got to meet a lot of interesting people from all different backgrounds. Most of them didn't even live in Vegas, and many of them were running their own successful businesses as their full-time occupation. Poker was just a fun hobby that they occasionally did on the side. I stopped playing in the California card rooms altogether. While I would continue to play poker throughout my life, poker stopped being a focus for me. I was far from a world-class player, but I had learned enough about the game that I was ready for something different. For me, the goal of all future poker games would no longer be trying to make money or improving my poker skills and experience. Moving forward, the goal and purpose of playing poker would be more about hanging out with friends, meeting interesting people, and building relationships. I'd realized that whether in poker, in business, or in life, it was easy to get caught up and engrossed in what I was currently doing, and that made it easy to forget that I always had the option to change tables. Psychologically, it's hard because of all the inertia to overcome. Without conscious and deliberate effort, inertia always wins. I'd started to force myself to think again about what I was trying to get out of life. I asked myself what I was trying to accomplish, what I wanted to do, and whether I should be sitting at a different table. From my poker experience, I knew it was never too late to change tables. I realized that once I had learned the basics of poker, I wasn't really building anything by spending endless hours in casinos playing the game. I realized that I needed to be doing something more fulfilling, and that maybe I was no longer playing the right game. After what felt like an intensive summer fling with the game of poker, I decided it was time for me to move on to something new. It was time for me to change tables. Dabbling. As I tried to figure out what I wanted to do next, I ended up doing a whole lot of dabbling. I dabbled in investing and day trading, putting money into the stock market and companies that I knew nothing about, and ended up losing a lot of money. I decided to invest in a movie called Christmas in the Clouds, in which I had a small cameo role. I ended up losing a lot of money in that, too. They were expensive lessons, but I guess what I ended up learning was that it's a bad idea to invest in industries you don't understand, in companies you don't have any control or influence over, or in people you don't know or trust. Over time, I kept asking myself, why was I investing anything at all? What was my goal, to make more money? That didn't make sense since I had already given up a lot of money when I walked away from Microsoft. I realized that the day trading and investing I was doing weren't really fulfilling. I didn't feel like I was really building anything new. It felt more like I was gambling, but with the odds stacked against me because I was investing money in things I didn't understand. I ultimately made the decision to pull out of almost all my stock market investments and to try to figure out something more meaningful to focus on instead. I had been checking in every week or two with the folks at Zappos, offering advice as needed, especially on the technology side. It was just a handful of people working at Zappos, but they were making good progress for such a small team. Alfred and I introduced Zappos to Michael Moritz at Sequoia and helped set up an initial meeting. We all felt good. The Zappos team was passionate about what they were doing, they were making great progress, and Alfred and I had talked of Zappos to Sequoia in our email introductions to them. We assured the Zappos folks that the meeting was more of a formality than a pitch. With their Link Exchange investment, Sequoia had turned a $3 million investment into over $50 million, basically multiplying their money by 17 in just 17 months. Alfred and I had credibility, and in our minds, it seemed like a relatively small thing to ask Sequoia for a few million dollars to put into Zappos.
What Happened Next by Fred. It wasn't pleasant. It was December 10th, and we knew we had until the 15th to raise more money. All we had was 5 days to find funding or Zappos would be out of business. I was in New York, attending every single shoe show to sell Zappos as a company and sign on more footwear brands. We were doing all that we could, basically hustling, expecting that phone call from Nick to see if Zappos was going to survive. I was having dinner at a restaurant when he broke the news. Sequoia had decided not to invest. I stepped outside to receive the call, and when I sat back down at the table, the waiter accidentally spilled a glass of water in my lap. I had to laugh. When it rained, it literally poured. After returning to California, Nick and I tried calling more venture capitalists to raise more money, but no one was willing to invest. On the afternoon of the 15th, all 12 of us in the company got together and did what most would naturally do: head down to Chevy's for a margarita. We knew we had given it our best shot and recognized it was a good run. For us, it just didn't happen to work out. After a few rounds, we headed back to the office around 4 o'clock and started cleaning out our desks.
Alfred and I were both a bit surprised when we learned that Sequoia wasn't interested in investing in Zappos. We reached out to Sequoia to find out what happened or if anything had gone wrong. We were told that the accomplishments of the team were impressive, given how small the team was and that the company had only been around for a few months. But Sequoia wasn't confident that this would ever end up being more than a niche business. They wanted to see more growth and progress in the company, and they suggested that we touch base again in a few months. Our original plan with Venture Frogs was to make a single small angel investment in each company and then pass them on to bigger venture capital companies like Sequoia a few months afterwards. So we were in a bit of a quandary with Zappos. Either we had to make another investment in Zappos with money from the Venture Frogs fund, or we had to let Zappos go out of business. Letting Zappos go out of business would have fit in better with our original investment strategy and philosophy, which was to invest in a lot of different internet companies with the expectation that a third would make money, a third would break even, and a third would go out of business. Zappos would simply fall into that last category. "What do you want to do about Zappos?" Alfred asked. "We have to make a decision today. They only have a couple of months of cash left, and Sequoia isn't interested in putting money in them for at least a few months. They want to see more progress." "If that happens, then they'll definitely fund them?" I asked. "Not definitely," Alfred replied, "but I think more likely than not. It's definitely a risk. We can give Zappos a few months more of cash to tide them over to the next meeting with Sequoia and hope that Sequoia will invest at that time. But if Sequoia doesn't, then we're going to wind up in the same situation we're in right now, except there probably won't be much money left in our fund by then." This was a tough call. If we decided to invest more money into Zappos, then that meant that we wouldn't be able to make an investment into another company. "It's definitely higher risk. Sort of like putting more eggs into a basket," I said. "But I like the guys there. They're passionate and determined, and they don't seem like they're doing this just to get rich quick. They're actually interested in building something for the long term." "Well, if you think we should put more money into Zappos, then we really should be spending more time with them in order to protect our investment," Alfred said. "We should get them to move into the incubator." As part of the investment strategy for our fund, Alfred and I had decided to start the Venture Frogs Incubator, where we would provide office space and services for internet companies. It would also allow us to work more closely with whichever companies were in the incubator. We had talked to the landlord of the building we lived in because there was still a lot of commercial space available for lease. Alfred and I decided to take over all of the remaining space. Our plan was to convert part of it into office space for the incubator and part of it into a restaurant. This way, there would be no reason for us and the companies we would incubate to leave the building. We would all be able to work longer and harder. The problem was that the incubator space was still under construction. "Yeah, I think that's a good idea, but the incubator isn't going to be ready for at least a few months," I said. "The next few months are going to be critical. They're going to make or break the company." "So, what do you want to do?" Alfred asked. I thought about all the possible options. "I have my birthday party this weekend and a New Year's party in 2 weeks. Let's have them move into my loft right after New Year's. We'll convert it into an office until the incubator offices are ready downstairs." "Sounds good."
The Phone Call by Fred. As we were packing up our things that afternoon, we got a call that we didn't expect. It was Tony. He had decided to invest another 3 to 4 months' worth with a couple of conditions. "You have to move into my loft in San Francisco, and I'm going to be much more involved in the company." Up until that time, we had just been sending Tony a sales report once a week and had seen him visit the office once with Alfred. We were busy running around doing our thing, but with this call, it was obvious he could see Zappos's potential. It was an easy decision to make. We packed up and moved from Emeryville into his loft, and for the next 12 months, Tony would invest 4 months at a time. Imagine never knowing if you were going to have a job at the end of 4 months. It would come down to the very last day when he'd decide whether or not he thought it was worthwhile. Fortunately for us, he did. So we just kept plugging away to make progress for those 4 month cycles. Wait to see if we've been given another 4 months of oxygen and get right back to digging in to make things happen. For that entire year, that's all we did. We hustled.
My Red Bull relationship. I have friends from all different walks of life. Some friends I enjoy hanging out with at bars. Some friends I enjoy watching movies with. Some friends I enjoy working with. Some friends I enjoy hiking with. And some friends I enjoy writing with, occasionally discussing what preposition not to end a sentence with. One of the longest relationships I've been able to maintain in my life has been with Red Bull. We recently celebrated our 10-year anniversary together. We had originally met at a nightclub in downtown San Francisco. A mutual friend introduced us and had a great time dancing the night away. Over time, our activities together expanded beyond the nightclub scene and became more and more varied. I think the reason why Red Bull has become such an integral part of my life is because of its versatility and ability to adapt to almost any situation. Red Bull has been my faithful companion almost everywhere I go, no matter what activity I'm doing, including drinking at bars, watching movies, working in the office, and hiking in the mountains. In fact, I'm sipping a Red Bull as I'm writing this and sitting next to my writing friends who are having trouble comprehending why I would feel compelled to write about my relationship with Red Bull. I guess at the end of the day, my thought is that it's pretty hard to find a good companion that's compatible with so many parts of your life and is always there to support you along the way. If you're able to find a companion that you wouldn't mind going with you to breakfast and to dinner, that helps you get through your post-lunch food coma at the office, as well as your final miles in a marathon, and that you can enjoy with or without alcohol, that's a pretty rare thing to come across. To me, that's a relationship worth keeping. Connectedness. My birthday party was coming up, and I wanted to make sure that it was unlike any birthday party I had ever thrown before. I decided to go all out for it. A few months earlier, I'd reconnected with some friends from high school, and similar to my college days, a core group of about 15 of us formed, and we started hanging out with each other several times a week. In the beginning, it wasn't purposeful or planned. It was just a byproduct of the fact that there were already so many of us living in the same building, so impromptu gatherings became more and more common. Sometimes we would hang out in someone's loft, and other times we would all plan on going to a nightclub or rave together. Slowly, we grew our community, and our building became the hub for not only our own friends, but also friends of our friends. Without realizing it, we created and developed our own tribe, and the most common meeting point became the loft that I lived in. As our group grew, I realized that forming new friendships and deepening the connections within our burgeoning tribe was bringing both a sense of stability and a sense of excitement about the future for all of us. The connectedness we felt was making all of us happier, and we realized it was something that we had all missed from our college days. It was something that, like many people, we had unwittingly lost upon graduating from college, and we didn't realize how much we missed it until we accidentally recreated it for ourselves. I made a note to myself to make sure I never lost sight of the value of a tribe where people truly felt connected and cared for the well-being of one another. To me, connectedness, the number and depth of my relationships, was an important element of my happiness, and I was grateful for our tribe. The purpose of my big birthday party coming up wasn't actually meant to focus on me. My birthday was just the excuse. The party I had been planning for months was going to be my gift to the tribe. Ever since selling Link Exchange, I committed to living by the philosophy that experiences were much more important to me than material things. Most people assumed that I would have gone out and bought a fancy and expensive car, but I was content with my Acura Integra. I already lived in a 1,400 square foot loft on the 7th floor of our building, and I had found out a few months earlier that a 3,500 square foot penthouse unit on the 8th floor was available for sale. It was unit number 810. I had no desire to move, but when I saw the layout of the 810 loft, I knew I had to buy it so that it could become the new gathering space for our tribe. There was one small bedroom and 3,000 square feet of wide open space. It was the perfect place for partying. I bought the 810 loft, not because I wanted to own more property, and not because I thought of it as a real estate investment. I bought 810 so I could architect our parties and gatherings. Owning the loft would ultimately enable more experiences. After successfully buying 810 in a bidding war against two other people, I started working on converting the loft into my vision of what it could one day become. During college, watching the hit TV show Friends with my roommates was a regular weekly event. I remembered how the characters in the show seemed to always gather at the local coffee shop called Central Perk to hang out and meet other people. I wanted 810 to become our tribe's own private version of Central Perk, and we needed to figure out a cool name for 810 instead of just calling it 810. I envisioned our friends gathering in 810 on Sundays for champagne brunches. I envisioned 810 as being the after-party meetup spot after a night out at a club, bar, or rave. And I envisioned converting 810 into our own private nightclub. The first official party of 810 would be on Saturday, December 11th, 1999. At midnight, I would turn 26. My birthday would be the perfect excuse to throw an inaugural party for 810. I made sure to stock plenty of Red Bull. I'd spent weeks preparing for my birthday party. Our tribe had attended several raves in the months leading up to my birthday. I remember the first rave party I had attended earlier that year, when I didn't even know what a rave was. All I knew was that they played a lot of techno and house music. I had gone to nightclubs before where they played the same type of music that they played at raves, and I remember thinking that the music was really annoying and not understanding why the biggest rooms in all the clubs always seemed to play that type of music. There were no words to the music, and it seemed like it was just the same repetitive beat playing over and over again incessantly. I just did not understand the appeal of electronic music. Knowing that it would be the same type of music, I wasn't too excited about going to a warehouse rave, but because everyone else in our tribe wanted to go, I decided to tag along. We all drove to a gigantic empty warehouse that seemed like it was in the middle of nowhere. There were hundreds of cars parked outside the warehouse, and we could hear the repetitive thumping of the electronic techno music as we waited outside in line. I secretly wondered how long we would be staying there, as I would have really preferred a venue with music that I recognized and had heard on the radio. After waiting in line for 20 minutes, we finally turned the corner and walked into the warehouse. What I experienced next changed my perspective forever. Streams of giant green laser beams were shooting throughout the entire warehouse, which was the size of 10 football fields. Fog machines created a sense of dreamlike surrealism as everyone faced the DJ and moved in unison to the beat of the music. Cans of Red Bull were strewn everywhere, and ultraviolet black lights caused the fluorescent decorations on the walls and ceilings to glow as if they were alien plants transported from another universe. But it wasn't just about the decorations, or the black lights, or the fog machines, or the lasers, or the massiveness of the warehouse. Something else about the scene and moment elicited an emotional response from my entire being that was completely unexpected, and I couldn't really place my finger on exactly what it was or why I felt that way. I tried to analyze what was different about this scene compared with the nightclub scene that I was more accustomed to. Yes, the decorations and lasers were pretty cool, and yes, this was the largest single room full of people dancing that I had ever seen. But neither of these things explained the feeling of awe that I was experiencing that was leaving me speechless. As someone who is usually known as being the most logical and rational person in a group, I was surprised to feel myself swept with an overwhelming sense of spirituality, not in the religious sense, but a sense of deep connection with everyone who is there, as well as the rest of the universe. There was a feeling of no judgment, and as I glanced around the warehouse, I saw each person as an individual to be appreciated just for being himself or herself, dancing to the music. As I tried to analyze what was going on in more detail, I realized that the dancing here was different from the dancing I usually witnessed in nightclubs. Here, there was no sense of self-consciousness or feeling that anyone was dancing to be seen dancing, whereas in nightclubs, there was usually the feeling of being on display somehow. In nightclubs, people usually dance with each other. Here, it seemed like almost everyone was facing the same direction. Everyone was facing the DJ, who was elevated up on stage as if he was channeling his energy to the crowd. It almost felt as if everyone was worshiping the DJ. The entire room felt like one massive united tribe of thousands of people, and the DJ was the tribal leader of the group. People weren't dancing to the music so much as the music seemed like it was simply moving through everyone. The steady, wordless, electronic beats were the unifying heartbeats that synchronized the crowd. It was as if the existence of individual consciousness had disappeared and been replaced by a single unifying group consciousness, the same way a flock of birds might seem like a single entity instead of a collection of individual birds. Everyone in the warehouse had a shared purpose. We were all contributors to the collective rave experience. I didn't know it at the time, but 10 years later, I would learn that research from the field of the science of happiness would confirm that the combination of physical synchrony with other humans and being part of something bigger than oneself, and thus losing momentarily a sense of self, leads to a greater sense of happiness, and that the rave scene was simply the modern-day version of similar experiences that humans have been having for tens of thousands of years. In the moment, though, I felt a sense of experiential epiphany. It swept through my entire being. In that instant, I suddenly understood the appeal of the techno music. I couldn't simply listen to it the way I listened to music on the radio. I had to let it flow through me in the context of a mindset that I hadn't really experienced until just now. It was like someone had bestowed on me the Rosetta Stone of techno music, and no amount of verbal explanation would have helped me understand it. I had to experience it for myself. And in that one instant, I did. I had awakened. I had been transformed. Finally, after all these years, I understood what the music was all about. Vision. Our tribe ended up going to a lot more raves together. Some were massive, with thousands and thousands of people. Some were small, with only 50. I learned more about the rave community and culture. I learned that PLUR, P-L-U-R, was an acronym that stood for Peace, Love, Unity, Respect, and that it was the mantra for how people were supposed to carry themselves and behave both at raves and in life. At raves, it was part of the culture and considered perfectly normal to approach complete strangers and strike up a conversation. Unlike the bar or nightclub scene, where that type of behavior is typically used by guys to try to pick up girls, at raves, people were genuinely interested in getting to know each other as just people, with no ulterior motive. The idea of PLUR and the rave culture rubbed off on me beyond the rave scene. To me, it was really more a philosophy about always being open to meeting people, no matter how they looked or what their backgrounds were. Every interaction with anyone, anywhere, was an opportunity to gain additional perspective. We're all human at the core, and it can be easy to lose sight of that in a world ruled by business, politics, and social status. The rave culture was a reminder that it was possible for the world to be a better place, for people to simply be appreciative of the humanity in one another. I learned to feel comfortable starting conversations with complete strangers, no matter where I was or who they were. I wound up writing about how I applied this strategy to business in Ivanka Trump's book, The Trump Card, Playing to Win in Work and Life. My excerpt for Ivanka Trump's book. I personally really dislike business networking events. At almost every one of these events, it seems like the goal is to walk around and find people to trade business cards with the hope of meeting someone who can help you out in business, and in exchange, you can help that person out somehow. I generally try to avoid those types of events, and I rarely carry any business cards around with me. Instead, I really prefer to focus on just building relationships and getting to know people as just people, regardless of their position in the business world or even if they're not from the business world. I believe that there's something interesting about anyone and everyone. You just have to figure out what that something is. If anything, I found that it's more interesting to build relationships with people that are not in the business world, because they can almost always offer unique perspectives and insights, and also because those relationships tend to be more genuine. If you're able to figure out how to be truly interested in someone you meet, with the goal of building up a friendship instead of trying to get something out of that person, the funny thing is, almost always, something happens later down the line that ends up benefiting either your business or yourself personally. I don't really know why this happens or why it works, but it seems that the benefit from getting to know someone on a personal level usually happens 2 to 3 years after you started working on building the relationship. And it's usually something that you could not have possibly predicted would have happened at the beginning of the relationship. For example, maybe your friend's sister's neighbor was just hired as the VP of a company that you've been trying to get in touch with. Or maybe someone that you met 2 years ago now has a new tennis partner who would be the perfect person for that job opening you've been trying to fill for the past 6 months. Zappos.com has been around for over 10 years now. We grew from no sales in 1999 to over $1 billion in gross merchandise sales in 2008. In looking back at the major turning points in the history of the company, it seems that most of them were the result of pure luck. Things happened that we could not have possibly predicted, but they were the result of relationships that we had started building 2 to 3 years earlier. So, my advice is to stop trying to network in the traditional business sense, and instead, just try to build up the number and depth of your friendships, where the friendship itself is its own reward. The more diverse your set of friendships are, the more likely you'll derive both personal and business benefits from your friendships later down the road. You won't know exactly what those benefits will be, but if your friendships are genuine, those benefits will magically appear 2 to 3 years later down the road. I wanted my 26th birthday to embody the same positive energy I experienced in the rave culture. So in the weeks leading up to it, I did everything I could to make sure it would be a night to remember. I went on an online shopping spree and ordered fog machines, color lights, light controllers, lasers, disco balls, black lights, fluorescent decorations, and trusses to hang the lights and lasers on. I wanted to recreate a smaller version of the warehouse rave environment. About 100 people showed up for my birthday party. I had put up signs from the elevator that said 810, along with an arrow pointing towards the party loft. The cousin of one of the members of our tribe saw the sign and asked, "What's bio?" The rest of us laughed. That was the name we were looking for. We decided to call the party loft Club Bio from that point forward. For the most part, my birthday party went off without a hitch. The most important lesson I learned was to not serve grapes at a party because the morning after, the entire kitchen floor was covered and stained with crushed grapes that had fallen onto the floor and been stepped on. It looked like I was running a vineyard inside Club Bio. I made a mental note to skip the fruit for my New Year's party. Word of mouth spread quickly about Club Bio, and several hundred people showed up for my New Year's party. There was a line from the elevator to the entrance of the loft. By 3 a.m., most of the partygoers had gone home. There were only about 30 people left, so I decided to crank up the output of the fog machines so that I could fill the entire loft with fog. Suddenly, strobe lights flashed repeatedly as a loud, shrill alarm started sounding. It took me a while to figure out where the noise was coming from and what was going on. The dense output of the fog machines had set off the smoke alarms not just for my loft, but for the entire building. It was 3 a.m., and the fire alarm was being sounded for all of the units. An automated voice announcement instructed everyone to evacuate the building immediately. I quickly turned off the fog machines and opened all the windows. The fog cleared after a few minutes, but by then it was too late. I heard the sound of sirens and looked outside the window to see two fire trucks approach the building with their lights flashing. A few minutes later, three firemen showed up at the door. I explained to them what had happened and showed them the lasers and the fog machine setup. When they realized that the building was not actually in danger of burning down, they started laughing, wished all of us a happy new year, and left the building. I was just happy that I wasn't arrested. I breathed a sigh of relief and leaned out one of the open windows to watch the firemen get back into their fire trucks below. The lights of the fire trucks were still flashing. Suddenly, I heard a female voice. Isn't it amazing? You created all of this. I looked over to see who it was, but it was someone I didn't recognize. She had blonde hair and blue eyes and was also leaning out the window to marvel at the flashing lights of the fire trucks below. Yeah, they were pretty nice about it. I was worried that they would be mad at me, especially since it's New Year's, I said. That's not what I meant. I mean, all of this, she said. She turned and gestured towards the rest of the people that were still at the party. You could have done anything you wanted, and you chose to create an experience that people will remember forever. Yeah, I don't think the other residents living here are going to be too happy with me when they find out why they had to evacuate the building in the middle of the night, I said. They're probably going to remember this night forever as well. She laughed. Oh, I wouldn't worry about it. It was an accident. You can blame it on the Y2K bug or something. I can see the headlines now. Fog machines gone awry. I smiled at her. Can you believe that this whole place is going to be converted into an office in a few days? She gazed into my eyes. I could still hear the music in the background, but the rest of the world seemed to disappear. I had no idea who this girl was, but somehow the universe had brought us together for a single moment in time that I would remember forever. Envision, create, and believe in your own universe, and the universe will form around you, she said softly, just like what you did tonight. She leaned over and whispered into my ear, Happy New Year. And then she got up and left without another word. Incubator. Her words stuck with me. Envision, create, and believe in your own universe. Although connecting with my new tribe of friends played a big role in increasing my level of happiness, I missed not actually being part of creating something. Just sitting on the sidelines and investing was boring. I wanted to be part of building something, and creating the Venture Frogs Incubator was an important piece to building my own universe. In addition to signing the lease for the office space of our future incubator, Alfred and I also signed a lease for a restaurant in the same building, which we would call Venture Frogs Restaurant. My parents had moved back from overseas and volunteered to run the Venture Frogs Restaurant over the next several years. The dishes in the restaurant were named after various dot-com companies. One of the crowd favorites ended up being the Akamai Fried Rice. We had a restaurant, a gym, movie theaters, incubator office space, and lofts, all under one roof. We hired a handful of employees to keep the incubator offices up and running. We were creating our own universe. With the Zappos crew moving into our building, initially into the converted party loft, and then eventually into the incubator office space, I started spending more and more time with the company. The raves I went to slowly became more and more commercialized, and the events started feeling like they were more about making money than they were about spreading the plur culture. They started to attract a different type of crowd, and people's attitudes at the events started to shift. I realized that I had discovered raves at the tail end of the movement. Without Club Bio as the party loft to serve as a central meetup location, the tribe that we had built slowly started drifting apart. We had been bound by a common purpose in the beginning, to form a community. It was exciting in the early days, because every day we saw our tribe grow and strengthen. But we lacked a shared purpose beyond just hanging out and partying. We still continued to keep in touch, but without something for us to make progress towards, and without a default meeting place that was the equivalent of Central Perk, different members of our tribe started focusing on other things that were going on in their lives. Some of us tried to figure out what our true passions were, so that we would have something better than partying to focus on. I was one of those people. I had always been passionate about planning and throwing parties because I really enjoyed the idea of architecting and creating experiences and memories. I enjoyed watching people's reactions and hearing them say, wow, when they walked into a party that was unlike any they had ever been to before. It was gratifying for people to come up to me at the end of the night or the next day and tell me what an incredible time they had. But as passionate as I was about all of that, I didn't see party planning as a full-time occupation for me. I thought of it more as a hobby that I was passionate about, and I needed to find something more meaningful that I could dedicate myself to full-time. They say that novelty is the biggest aphrodisiac. Making the initial investment to fund new ideas and companies was exciting, but in a relatively short period of time, Alfred and I had made 27 investments, and there was no more money left in the fund. Without more investment capital, we couldn't get involved with any new companies, and the excitement of being an investor wore off quickly. At the time, almost every idea we heard seemed like a great idea, so the money went quickly. We would find out 10 years later that, on average, we had made a slight profit on most of the companies we invested in, but the vast majority of the profits from the fund would come from Zappos. It turns out, venture investing is a lot like poker. The one who makes the most money isn't the one who tries to play and win as many hands as possible. At the end of 2009, we had distributed over 5.8 times the initial fund amount to our investors, making Venture Frogs one of the top-performing funds from 1999. In April 2000, the high-flying dot-com stock started to crash in the stock market, causing widespread panic throughout Silicon Valley. Many companies went out of business, and the venture capital firms that we were counting on to take our portfolio companies to the next level scaled back and refused to provide additional funding for almost all of our investments. A couple of companies moved into our new incubator office space, but without additional funding, they stopped paying their bills and went out of business a few months after that. Eventually, Zappos was the only company left in the incubator, and we weren't optimistic about the prospects of any other companies moving in anytime soon. It was a bad situation for our fund, for the incubator, and for Zappos. Alfred and I originally had the ambitious goal of raising a second fund of $100 million. We had done all the paperwork and asked investors who had participated in our original fund if they wanted to put money into our second fund. Our first fund had been a great vehicle for meeting a lot of interesting companies and people in a relatively short amount of time. As general managers of the fund, we had taken the idea of having the universe come to us and made it happen. We enjoyed learning about new companies, meeting new people, entertaining new ideas, and making new investments. The problem was that, once the investments had all been made, most of our time was spent dealing with companies that were not doing well and were unable to raise additional venture capital money to keep them going. We thought our best bet was to raise a second fund. If we could raise $100 million, then we could provide the next round of funding for the portfolio companies from our first fund to get them to the next level. We sent out an email to our previous investors to get an idea of how many would be interested in participating, and then waited anxiously for their response. As it turned out, not a single person was interested. We ended up raising exactly $0. Up until this point, I hadn't been too worried about the dot-com crash. Even though Link Exchange had been a bad experience from a culture perspective, financially, it was a success story. Alfred and I had used our credibility from the Link Exchange sale to raise the $27 million for our first fund, so we naturally assumed that it wouldn't be that hard to raise money for our second fund. We were wrong. I started to have feelings of self-doubt. I wondered whether I had just gotten lucky with Link Exchange. Was I just a dot-com lottery winner who happened to be in the right place at the right time? Alfred and I had continued to keep in touch with Michael Morris at Sequoia about Zappos, and despite the progress that Zappos was making, Sequoia was still not interested in investing. I believed with all my heart that Zappos had a great shot at succeeding. I felt that I needed to prove to myself and to Sequoia that the financial success of Link Exchange was not a fluke, that it wasn't just dumb luck. I wanted to prove to the world that I could do it again. So I decided to take off my investor and advisor hat and put on my entrepreneur hat again. I joined Zappos full-time later that year. I decided that Zappos was going to be the universe that I wanted to help envision and build. It would be the universe that I believed in. My search over the past few months was finally over. I had figured out what I wanted to focus on for at least the next few years. I had discovered my new passion. I was passionate about proving everyone wrong.
Tweets to live by. A great company is more likely to die of indigestion from too much opportunity than starvation from too little. Packard's Law. You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. John Kabat-Zinn. told ghost stories with friends last night, now wondering whether ghosts sit around campfires and tell each other people's stories. To dare is to lose one's footing momentarily. To not dare is to lose oneself. Søren Kierkegaard. Be humble. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few. Shunryu Suzuki.
Section 2. Prophets and Passion. Chapter 4. Concentrate Your Position. Figuring Things Out. The next 2 years were stressful at Zappos. We were just focused on survival. We knew we had no choice but to succeed. We went through a recession, the dot-com stock market crash, and 9/11. At every turn, it felt like the universe was testing our commitment and our passion. We knew we couldn't raise any funding externally. Although it went against our investment strategy, since I was now personally working full-time at Zappos, Alfred and I decided to invest some more money from the Venture Frogs Fund. But eventually, we had used up what little money was left in the fund. Because the fund was out of money, every few months, I would take a look at my own bank account and personally put a little more money into the company in order to keep it afloat. Alfred and I continued to reach out to Sequoia, but they still weren't interested in investing. In October 2000, I sent the following email out stressing the importance of getting the company to profitability before we ran out of cash and cutting back on a lot of things that we wanted to do. Date, October 19th, 2000. From Tony Shea to Zappos employees. Subject, 9-month plan. Zapponians, I just wanted to send out an email to everyone about our company priorities over the next 9 months so that everyone can get a better idea of how different people's roles fit into the big picture. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. As you all know, the market has been pretty bad over the past 6 months for business-to-consumer, or B2C, companies, both in the public markets and in the private VC markets. Once high-flying public companies such as eToys, FogDog, Planet RX are now at all-time lows. High-profile private companies such as Miadora.com, which was doing $1 million a month in revenue and was funded by Sequoia, the funders of Yahoo, have gone out of business because VCs are afraid to fund B2C companies now. These market conditions have been both good and bad for Zappos.com. On the positive side, it means that we won't have to worry about a competitor suddenly getting $25 million in funding and spending it on Super Bowl ads, confusing the marketplace, and in general giving us a lot of short-term headaches. On the downside, it means that, because we are constrained by cash, we won't be able to grow as quickly as we'd like to, or do all the things we'd like to. And there are a lot of things that would be nice to do if we had the money, such as doing a national ad campaign, growing our customer service and fulfillment team more quickly, spending more on development resources, putting more features into the new site, and much, much more. But the reality is that, at this time, we can't do everything we want to do because of cash constraints. Right now, because we are unprofitable with very limited cash, we are in a race against time. Our number one priority as a company right now is to get to the other side. Once we are profitable, we are in control of our own destiny and can start doing a lot more of the things that we would like to do. Until that time, we need to make sure that as a company, we stay focused on maximizing our chances of getting to profitability before we run out of money. We have a financial plan in place that makes sense and is within our reach of accomplishing, but we have to make sure that we all understand what's required in order to follow the plan. So, first and foremost, we need to watch our expenses very carefully. We have a budget set aside for hiring, which will need to be followed very carefully, and we won't be able to hire as many people as we'd like in any of our departments. After watching expenses, our most important priority is to maximize the gross profit we make over the next 9 months. This translates into increasing the average gross profit and order size per customer, increasing conversion rates, increasing new qualified visitors to our site, and increasing the percentage of repeat customers. In evaluating new projects for the company over the next 9 months, we need everyone to think about how it will increase our total gross profit over the next 9 months. This will mean that some projects we might normally pursue will be put on hold until we get to profitability. Once we get to profitability, Then we'll be able to think longer term and bigger picture, and fantasize more about how to rule the world. As I mentioned above, if anyone has any questions about how things fit into our 9-month plan, please, don't hesitate to ask. We knew that just harping on the urgency of the situation wasn't going to be enough. We had to take more drastic measures. Nick, Fred, and I decided to do a round of layoffs in order to maximize our chances of survival. And we had to figure out how to get the remaining employees to either take big pay cuts or work for free in exchange for equity in the company. My salary was set to $24 a year, or $1 per paycheck, although that was before taxes. In November 2000, Nick sent me this email.
Date, November 26th, 2000. From Nick Swinburne to Tony Shea. Subject, stuff. I don't have any input on funding. Unfortunately, seems like you are the only option, so I guess you need to decide what makes sense for you, and then we react accordingly. If you don't have more money for Zappos, then we should look at what we have left and figure out now how we can make it last as long as possible with our skeleton crew. As for me taking another pay cut, once my old landlord admits he owes me more money and I sell a few things to a friend, I should be completely out of debt, leaving my only costs as rent, car, and food. Biggest wild card is rent and deposit. As long as pay covers my costs, I'll be fine. I think even though we still have problems, we're on the right track. Marketing is now close to a proper percent of revenue. Technically, we're much more efficient, and we seem to know what needs to happen for this to work. Frustrating, because I think we all know we can make it. It's just a question of if we can survive long enough.
Other employees came up with creative solutions.
After carefully considering the choices, I've decided not to switch to any of the alternate packages offered. However, I recognize that Zappos wants, needs, to trim back on spending, so I have a counteroffer. The main thing I'm interested in right now is expanding my personal time. I'd be willing to take a 20% pay cut in exchange for one extra day per week off.
As things started to look more and more bleak, some people decided to leave the company. Most employees didn't have any savings, so taking a big pay cut or working for free meant that they wouldn't be able to pay their rent. So we racked our brains trying to come up with more creative solutions. The party loft I had was actually empty now that Zappos had moved into the incubator offices, so I put 5 beds in A10, formerly Club Bio, and started housing employees there without charging them rent. I also owned 3 other lofts in the building and housed some incubator and Zappos employees, including Nick, in there as well, and also let them live there without charging rent. Of the people remaining, we lived by an all-for-one, one-for-all credo, and did everything we could to keep the company afloat. Everyone remaining stepped up and worked harder than before, and we were pleasantly surprised to find that the layoffs actually didn't hurt the company's productivity. We realized that we had laid off the underperformers and the non-believers, but because everyone remaining was so passionate about the company and believed in what we were doing, we could still accomplish just as much work as we had before. It was a big lesson in the power of instilling passion throughout the entire company and working as a unified team. Everyone was making sacrifices. But it still wasn't enough to get us to profitability. I continued to put some of my own personal cash into the company every few months, but I knew it wasn't sustainable. The company was still losing too much cash every month. As the money in my personal bank account started dwindling away, I began selling the real estate that I owned so that I could put the proceeds from each sale back into Zappos. I eventually ended up selling every property I had bought, except for the one I lived in and the party loft. I had wanted to sell the party loft, but the economy was so bad that there simply were no interested buyers. On top of that, the restaurant that my parents were running was not meeting its sales projections, in part due to the economy and in part because none of us had any restaurant experience. The situation was dire. Everything I was involved in was running out of money, including the restaurant, the incubator, Zappos, and myself personally. The only backup plan I had for myself personally was the thought that whenever the economy would eventually turn around, I would be able to sell the party loft and convert that into cash. That would be my cushion and safety net, although I had no idea when the economy would eventually turn around or how long it would take to sell a loft like that. Nick, Fred, and I looked at other areas in the business where we could try to cut expenses, Even though it would hurt our growth, we decided to cut most of our marketing expenses and refocus our efforts on trying to get the customers who had already bought from us to purchase again and more frequently. Little did we know that this was actually a blessing in disguise, as it forced us to focus more on delivering better customer service. In 2003, we would decide to make customer service the focus of the company. Even so, at the time, our number one priority was not customer service. It was simply survival. The need to survive and figure things out had an unanticipated consequence. It brought all of us closer together because we all shared the same goal of not going out of business. Even though we were going through some tough times, we were going through everything together, and we were all fiercely passionate about what we were doing. We had all made sacrifices in our own way because we all believed in the potential and future of the company. Without realizing it, Zappos had become my new tribe. Believe. Looking at the company's financials, it became pretty clear that just focusing on cutting expenses wasn't going to get the company to profitability. We needed to figure out a way to grow sales. This was a particularly challenging problem because we had cut back most of our marketing budget. We were already focusing more on getting the customers we already had to shop with us more often, but that alone wouldn't get us very far in the short term. What we really needed was a miracle. In high school, I'd taken a Greek history class and learned about Deus ex machina, which is a Latin phrase that literally translates into God from the machine. According to Wikipedia, it is a plot device in which a person or thing appears out of the blue to help a character overcome a seemingly insolvable difficulty. It is generally considered to be a poor storytelling technique. As I sat in the office at my desk, pondering what to do next, I turned to Fred. I didn't care if this would make for a bad story later, as long as we could figure out how to save the company. Fred, do you have a Deus ex machina? I asked. A what? Fred was confused. Deus ex machina, I repeated. You know, a Greek miracle. Oh, no, sorry, he replied. I accidentally left mine at home in my shirt pocket. Maybe we can find one over a drink, I said. It's 4 p.m., and we need to figure out how to save the company. Is it too early for a drink? Of course not. So we stopped what we were doing and headed over to the bar at Venture Frog's restaurant. I ordered a Grey Goose soda, and Fred ordered a beer. We sipped our drinks in silence for a few minutes. I broke the ice. So, any ideas on how to increase sales more quickly? Fred looked pensive. I come from a merchandising background. I like to say that all we need is the right product at the right time in the right quantity, and the sales will take care of themselves. The problem is, we don't carry the brands or the styles that I know will sell. We just don't have the right products to offer our customers. How do we get the right products? The problem is that a lot of brands that we want to carry can't dropship, Fred said. Their systems and warehouses aren't set up to send the orders from their warehouse directly to our customers. And even for the brands that can dropship, usually they're sold out of the best stuff, so we wouldn't be able to offer those styles to our customers. I paused for a moment to think about what Fred was saying. So, how come all the brick-and-mortar stores are able to offer all the best-selling brands and styles? I asked. Because they hold and own the inventory, Fred explained. The brick-and-mortar retailers future out their orders ahead of time, pay for the inventory, and take the inventory risk. If a retailer isn't able to sell something, then that's the retailer's problem, not the brand's or wholesaler's problem. But we can't do that, because that's not our business model. We had both finished our drinks. Another drink? I asked. Fred nodded solemnly and motioned for the bartender to bring us another round. So, what if we did that? I said, thinking out loud. What if we carried all the inventory of the brands and styles you wanted? How much do you think our sales would go up by? Oh, we'd easily triple sales. No question, Fred said without hesitation. Probably even more than that. Okay, let's figure out what we need to do to make that happen. If changing our business model is what's going to save us, then we need to embrace and drive change. Fred and I spent the next hour talking through all the different challenges that we would have to address if we wanted to start carrying inventory in addition to the dropshipping business that we were already doing. By the end of the hour, we felt we had a pretty good list. The list was daunting, but at least we now knew what we had to do to save the company. 1. We would need to hire and grow a buying team to decide what products to buy and to manage the inventory.